You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, women tend to report higher stress levels compared to men. We'll find out why coming up.
First, as the opioid crisis continues to cause more overdoses and deaths around the country, children are often left feeling the traumatic impacts of neglect or of being removed from their parents' custody. Many end up living in foster care and moving from school to school.
That presents a lot of challenges when it comes to getting a normal education. A new project by the Huffington Post and the nonprofit education news service, the Hetchinger Project, looks at how schools and the foster system are handling those vulnerable students.
Caroline Preston is a senior editor at the Hetchinger Report. Caroline, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Rebecca Klein is an education reporter at the Huffington Post. Rebecca, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much.
Caroline, let's start with you. Opioids, schools, the foster system. This is a pretty far-reaching series of reports. How did you and Rebecca decide to look into how these all interact and impact young people?
We were interested in looking at foster youth because their outcomes educationally tend to be quite poor. Only about 58% of young people in foster care graduate high school by age 19, whereas for the broader population, it's above 80%. And college graduation rates are, according to estimates, somewhere between 2 and 9%. So obviously those numbers are pretty discouraging, and we wanted to take a deeper look at what some of the specific challenges were and also what some potential solutions are.
And Rebecca, we talk a lot on the show, on the network, about rising trends in opioid overdoses, deaths, many of the impacts as a result of that. Can you give us a sense of how that epidemic is affecting where kids end up living and also where they end up going to school?
Sure. So overall, the foster care intake rate has increased around the country with some really drastic spikes in specific states like Indiana. When you're in the foster care system, it's more likely that you're going to switch schools based on where you're living. And when you switch schools, studies show that on average you lose about 4 to 6 months of learning every time. So it's really impacting their ability to get an education as they switch schools more frequently and as they are absent more often just due to the overall transitions and neglect and trauma they might be experiencing.
And are there commonalities about the schools where they end up when they get put in, say, foster placement that makes it even harder for them when they are trying to get a good education?
I think it really depends on where they are. Every state is different in terms of what happens when they go to school. But I would say in general, the commonalities are is that it's more difficult for them to succeed. They've experienced a lot of trauma, and school systems often, unfortunately, allow these students to fall through the cracks as they cycle in and out, and they have educators who aren't necessarily equipped to deal with the array of issues that they're coming to school with.
And Rebecca, can you take us into the classroom when children experience the neglect or trauma that comes with growing up around drug abuse? How does that manifest itself in the classroom with other children?
Sure. So I spent some time in a classroom in West Virginia where around half of the students weren't living with their biological parents. They were either living with foster parents or they were living with grandparents or family friends. And it was really difficult to get a child engaged on an educational level and get them to focus when they might be worried about where they're going to sleep at night, whether or not they're going to have food on the table, what might be happening with their biological parents who might be addicted or in jail. Overall, they just were less engaged than you might find in a typical classroom, and the teacher had to work just as hard, more hard to get them ready to learn.
And Caroline, tell us a little bit about that aspect of the crisis from the teacher's perspective. What are they needing to do in the classroom and outside the classroom to support their kids that really falls outside of the normal purview of being an educator?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that was something that Rebecca found in West Virginia, is that teachers, I think she writes, just as much as sort of medical professionals and others are really kind of first responders to the opioid crisis. I spent some time in a school in the South Bronx that's focused on working with kids who are in foster care, whose families are receiving services to sort of keep them from having to enter foster care, as well as kids from a low-income community. And in that school, there were two teachers per classroom at the elementary level. There were sort of people on call who could deal with behavioral issues as they came up. And kids were, if they needed it, getting 30 minutes or more a week of mental health counseling. So that was sort of an effort to not have everything fall on the classroom teacher, but it is a lot and it is tough.
And Caroline, other than places like that school that you just referred to in the South Bronx, where they are intentionally creating a community for and with children in foster care, if it's a teacher who is not in a specialized program like that, but is dealing with and trying to help kids who are in foster care, who are in their class, are they getting the resources that they need to even know what they should be doing?
It's a big challenge. I remember writing a story from Cincinnati where there was a program started about a decade ago that sprung out of teachers having frustrations because kids, for example, were being pulled out of math class to have a meeting that their caseworker had arranged or to see a biological parent, and sometimes the kid would just kind of go missing and they weren't sure if the kid would be coming back. And in that sense, improved communication between the child welfare and the education systems was really key, and I think you're starting to slowly see that in other places as a result of federal legislation, education legislation that was passed in 2015 that's requiring those two agencies to collaborate more and to ideally stabilize kids in their schools and give teachers more support.
Rebecca Klein is an education reporter at the Huffington Post, and Caroline Preston is a senior editor at the Hechinger Report. We are talking about the intersection of the opioid crisis, foster care, and education in a recent series of articles that they produced. And Caroline, for kids who don't have relatives to live with after either the arrest or death of a parent or after they are taken away from a parent because of neglect or abuse, the foster care system is a likely destination. Can you tell us what happens when a child goes into non-family foster placement and has to continue their education somewhere else? What are the steps that happens to try to make that happen?
Well, there's been a real movement to place kids with families as opposed to in institutional settings, and then even ideally in kinship placements, so whether it's a grandparent or an aunt or something like that. But older kids do still end up in group settings, sometimes because they may have mental health or behavioral problems that make it challenging to place them with families in a more family-friendly setting, but also sometimes because there just aren't enough family placements. Some of those kids who are in those residential settings sometimes end up going to school on campuses. One thing we found is that those residential schools aren't really set up to have the same offerings as public schools, and academics kind of take a back seat to treatment and some other issues. So that's obviously a barrier. But I think, again, going back to the issue of stability, keeping kids, if they are placed with a family, hopefully they can stay with that family and stay in the school. If they do have to move, there's more of an effort now, again, with this federal legislation, to keep them in the same school by providing them transportation to go to the kind of their school of origin. But that's tough. And I think one thing we found with our reporting is that may not be happening to the extent that the legislation was meant for it to.
And Caroline, I want to go back to those residential facilities for a moment. Are these state or county-run facilities? Are they private? Who is running these residential facilities?
They're really a mix. Some are large for-profit contractors. Some are nonprofit large contractors. Some are small, religiously affiliated. We took a deep dive on the state of Pennsylvania, and they were registered under different parts of the state's code and varied quite a bit in sort of their size and approach.
And Rebecca, what kind of oversight is there? Is anyone paying attention to what's going on in these facilities?
Oversight is pretty relaxed. There's not a ton of accountability. So what you see is kids oftentimes being left to languish without the proper transparency or channels to get change.
We are talking with Caroline Preston and Rebecca Klein about their series of reports looking at how schools and the foster system are struggling to educate kids dealing with trauma, much of that fueled by the opioid crisis.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you seeing this firsthand? If you're an educator, if you work in the schools, have you dealt with students who were affected by the opioid epidemic, maybe removed from homes, or dealing with parents who have dealt with overdose or incarceration because of opioids? How do you approach those situations? Or if this is something going on in your family, can you talk about your kids or grandkids or nephew or niece's story and how it's all working out for them? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org.
We'll pick up the conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time.
We're picking up our conversation with Caroline Preston of the Hechinger Report and Rebecca Klein from the Huffington Post, talking about how the education and foster care systems are responding to a rise in children dealing with trauma or neglect at home, often related to the opioid epidemic.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think could be done to better support kids who might have absent parents, whether it's services in school or something else? If you spent some of your childhood in foster care, did it make your education more challenging? And if you work in a school, have you seen the impacts of the opioid crisis on kids? When you know a student is dealing with trouble outside of school, what do you do? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@WPR.org. And Rebecca, are there resources that you got the sense teachers and administrators in regular schools really want that could help them better respond to kids dealing with trauma or who have been removed from their parents and are undergoing that separation?
The main thing I think teachers crave is information and collaboration with the social service agencies that are working with the kids. So sometimes they don't even receive all the information as to what might be happening in a child's life. So the child might be acting out in class. It might be clear that something's happening, but they don't know what, and therefore it's harder for them to serve this child and meet them where they are.
And Rebecca, it sounds like in some of these cases that you talked with the students or people in the schools, that the symptoms of trauma can actually be interpreted as a disability, and that can actually follow children and young people through their whole educational career and beyond.
Yeah, absolutely. So trauma sets you back tremendously, especially at that age when your brain is so malleable. So they might fall behind in school very quickly and then become stigmatized for a long time in their education career.
Let's go to the phones at 800-642-1234. Sarah in Milwaukee is up. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I am actually a caseworker in Milwaukee. I have been working as a caseworker for 2 years, and I am just so happy to hear discussion around this topic because, in fact, today I practice with a strong belief that relationships are kind of what these kids need, a strong sense of relationship in all aspects of case management. So these kiddos need to know that their caseworkers have a relationship with them. The caseworkers, I think it was already said, but that they need to have a relationship with the teachers and with the foster parents. And, in fact, just today I had a meeting with school professionals to talk about a kiddo who is experiencing some significant trauma. And you know what? We have an awesome game plan to ensure that this kid's going to come back to school and everybody knows where he's at and why, kind of how we're all going to support him. And I think that has been the key in ensuring that these kiddos get some stability, because you're right, the trauma that they're going through is just, it puts them back even further. So if we're all on the same page with positive relationships and positive intent, I think that's kind of where everything needs to go.
And Sarah, what happens when one of those pieces, it sounds like in this particular case, all the parts are working well together for the benefit of this child. What happens when one of those elements is missing or isn't on the same page?
I mean, a lot of times when one of those elements isn't on the same page, it's usually because of personal reasons. A foster parent doesn't want a kid to go home, or professionals have disagreements in kind of what's causing the behaviors or what needs to be the resolution. And I think at the end of the day, I think that at the end of the day, when all of these professionals are not on the same page or we're not communicating, it ultimately affects the ability to provide consistent and stable care for these kids. And we're as professionals showing these kids the positive relationships. And if we can't have positive relationships amongst our professionals when caring for this kid, how is this kid supposed to move forward and have a positive relationship with their foster parent, with their teachers, with their own parents, with their siblings, with their foster siblings? And I think it starts with the professional.
Sarah, thanks so much for that call. And Caroline, what Sarah was describing there reminds me of that school in New York that actually not just puts up with having foster kids, but embraces having foster kids and wants to help other kids not have to go into foster care through the school's efforts. What are those pieces that make that program so successful?
Well, both Rebecca and Sarah talked about information sharing and transparency. And one thing that comes to mind with that school in the South Bronx is that there's a lot of communication between the kids' caseworkers, the kids who are in foster care, and the teachers and the administrators. They even have a shared database. So if a kid is having a tough day, the teacher might go and look and see in that database, oh, the caseworker entered something about a difficult visit with that child's parent the night before, or something like that. So that can really help. I think they're also additional mental health supports like the counseling I mentioned earlier, and a real focus on social and emotional learning, being able to regulate one's emotions, communicate how you're feeling, take steps to try to mitigate bad feelings. Like for some kids, it might be having a specific stuffed animal. For others, it might be going and taking water breaks sometimes, or having a specific interventionist teacher who that kid is assigned to. So all of those things can help.
Thanks again for that call, Sarah. Let's go now to Marie in Green Bay. Hi, Marie.
Hi. I'm calling because this is a subject that is so complex. I have two kids in placement.
Good day.
Thank you. I have two kids in placement, and the Department of Social Services, the foster care system, I mean, it's just such a slow churning dynamic, and these kids seem to get lost in the middle of all the adults doing all the work around them. And I just want to say it's so important for that communication piece, because often when I have glitches with the kiddos that I have, it is usually because the adults are failing to communicate properly with each other.
Thanks for that call, Marie. And so Marie has two foster children in her care. And Caroline, one of the examples that you shared from that school in the South Bronx was a parent who so appreciated her children were still with her, and they were trying to keep her children with her. And she so appreciated the really hands-on direct communication that she got from the school.
Yes. I mean, in that case, that was a parent who was receiving preventive services, mental health counseling that's available through the city, through the city's child welfare agency to sort of help keep her family together. But she, you know, she worried that something might happen and she might lose her kids, but she felt like this school, more so than some other schools, was a really supportive environment that was committed to keeping her family together. And in one case, the school's director of social services, when this woman was having issues with her ex and her son went in and said, we have some domestic violence issues at home, the sort of school's director of social services even helped her stepped in and helped her get a court order against her ex. So it was, a supportive environment, like well beyond the walls of the classroom.
Rebecca, are there any instances of that really strong communication that creates a real safety net for these children that stands out to you from the people that you talked with?
Yeah, sure. There was one meeting that I sat in on, and it was a child. He was, I believe he was 8 at the time, and he was living not with his parents, not with his grandparents, but his great-grandparents. His parents and his grandparents were involved with drug use. So he was in a difficult situation. He didn't have someone there to wake him up in the morning because his great-grandfather, who was a primary caretaker, had to work in the morning, and he didn't have somebody putting him to bed at night. So he had a really hard time just kind of getting to school and being engaged when he got there. But he had his representative from the child welfare system coming and meeting with his teacher and school administrators regularly. And there was a lot of behavioral issues, as you could imagine, in the classroom. But every time they met, they came with a specific goal in mind, and they outlined a specific plan. They also kept in touch with, he had some medical issues, and so they were very on top of his physical health and trying to help the family be on top of that as well. And it's hard to say whether or not that's ultimately going to be an educational success, but without all of this collaboration, I think he would be in a much worse position.
Well, Rebecca and Caroline, thanks so much for joining us today and helping us sort through this really complex issue.
Thank you so much.
Rebecca Klein is an education reporter at the Huffington Post, and Caroline Preston is a senior editor at the Hechinger Report. Their new series looks at schools, foster homes, and the opioid crisis, and that series is called Twice Abandoned.
Stress is often a part of our daily lives between work, finances, kids, and more. Most of us will feel stressed from time to time, but new evidence finds that women experience more stress on average compared to men.
According to research, women typically take on more domestic and emotional labor, which compounds other causes of stress, like work.
Kristen Wong is a freelance writer and journalist. She recently wrote the New York Times piece, "There's a Stress Gap Between Men and Women. Here's Why It's Important." Kristen, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, a lot of women out there might feel individually, I'm stressed. I feel like I'm having more stress maybe than the men around me. Research out there, there are studies out there that suggest it's not just them. It's a thing.
It is a thing. I think it's a thing for all of us. Men and women, we all kind of feel stressed. But studies are showing that women report feeling, you know, they're twice as likely to suffer from severe stress and anxiety as men. The American Psychological Association reports there's a gender gap every year that women are consistently reporting higher stress levels. And a psychologist that I talked to said it's not really news to her because I guess she sees this in her practice a lot. And also it's a pretty well-documented thing that women are reporting more stress than men.
We'll dig into the why. We'll spend a lot of time on that. But let's talk about the consequences. This is not just you feel a little bad today and tomorrow and you get over it. There are potentially long-term health hazards here, right?
Yeah. I mean, there are definitely physical things that you want to watch out for, like heart disease, things like that. When women are at risk of heart disease, they're more likely to experience disturbed sleep, anxiety, and unusual fatigue before like a heart attack. And so these are kind of symptoms that I think people in general, but women especially, chalk up as just, oh, well, I always feel stressed. I always feel like this. So then it kind of goes unnoticed, and you don't really take it very seriously when it could lead to something very serious.
Now let's get into the why. What is it about women's lives in these United States that makes them, on average, more stressful than men?
Well, there's a lot. There are a handful of different things that could be causing it. And so in the article that I wrote, we kind of explore what some of these causes could possibly be. One of them is that women, are still doing a lot more unpaid domestic work. So they're doing a lot of housework, and that's often overlooked as actual work, even though it is laborious. As any paid job, I mean, that's like a thing that you pay people to do. Women are still doing three times as much unpaid domestic work as men, according to reports from the United Nations. So this is something that's still happening. So there's, you know, there's certainly things like that that perhaps are causing it. But there's also this idea of emotional labor. And emotional labor is kind of just like the emotions and feelings that you process with any given job. And it seems like a lot of that emotional labor falls on women more often than it falls on men. So there was a study that came out in 2016, I think, that looked at emotional labor in the workplace in terms of gender. So they noticed that women are much more likely to engage in a form of emotional labor. This is according to the study, a form of emotional labor called surface acting. And this is basically just faking it. Like if you're really upset and you're going to put a smile on anyway and pretend like you're not upset, women are much more likely to do that than men. And they found that that also causes stress. So it could be that this concept of emotional labor, you know, happens to women more. They're more likely to take on that labor, and that labor then causes stress.
And in the home, I think of, I'll maybe overshare here. In my family, I thought, oh, we divvy up the chores. I've been married to a woman for a long time, divvy up the chores pretty well. I was kind of blind to something that I've started calling logistical labor. Like, are the kids signed up for school? Did we make their annual physical appointment? That kind of stuff fell to my wife. And if I noticed it, I thought, well, she's better at that stuff anyway. I think that's probably super common that we're just blind to that kind of thing. And then you're carrying that planning, if you're the woman in this case, in your head. And that's a source of stress, right?
Absolutely. That is sort of just labor, right? Like having to keep track of everyone's schedules and make sure everyone's doing well. The stress that then comes with that and the anxiety that then comes with that and the push to kind of keep a happy face on, even though you're under all the stress, I think then that would be emotional labor. But I do think, women are kind of socialized to be that person, to be the person who is the peacekeeper, to be the accommodator, to be the caretaker. And that can be a source of labor on its own. So there are other, you know, when you are socialized to be that person that's expected of you, then that just manifests itself in so many other ways that then become little tasks that you have to keep up with. So that could be something that's contributing to this stress gap.
Talking to writer and author Kristen Wong, talking about her New York Times piece headlined, "There's a Stress Gap Between Men and Women. Here's Why It's Important." The gist: women feeling, carrying more stress. And this might not be taken seriously by society as a whole, or even the women, I would imagine, Kristen, because maybe each of these individual little instances, it looks like a little thing. But you put 43 of those together, all of a sudden it's a big thing.
Yeah, I think also, you know, to your point, a lot of it goes unnoticed. It's so expected that you don't really think of it as work, so you don't really question it, you know, until somebody kind of writes an article and they talk about all these. And the reason this concept of emotional labor got popularized was there's a writer, Jess Zimmerman, who had written about this in 2015, and her, you know, the phrase had kind of already been around, but she really got women talking about this. And so it spurred this Metafilter thread where hundreds of women were chiming in and saying like, oh yeah, you know what? Now that you mention it, I have to do X, Y, and Z. And I didn't even consider that labor. So yeah, I think a lot of it just goes unnoticed.
And I'll say, I didn't look at the comments to your article, Kristen, but are you seeing a similar response either, you know, on the New York Times website or from people you know? Are a lot of people saying, hey, yeah, this is going on with me?
Yeah, you know, every time I talk to a friend about it, and I kind of, you know, I'll talk to them about this concept, something kind of clicks over and they're like, oh yeah, you're right. I didn't think that this, I just thought this was something kind of expected of me, but this does require extra work on my part. I think a lot of women can relate to it. And I also think, like, there is some skepticism around it, I think. Like, men get stressed out, too, which I think is worth pointing out because we're talking about, like, gender-based stress in this situation. But it's not to say that men are also not very stressed out. Men and women, we are all very stressed out, as I said. It's just that there's this different kind of stress that I think is worth exploring that's sort of either caused by your gender expectations or at least fueled by them, if that makes sense.
So you also write about what women can do about this. You start with this idea, this phrase that's out there a lot, of self-care. What's a good way to tackle self-care when it comes to this, as you say, gender-driven bonus stress.
I like that phrase. I think self-care is a really misunderstood concept. People tend to think of self-care as indulgent, as a luxury thing. Self-care is just exactly what it sounds like, taking care of yourself, making sure you get an adequate amount of sleep because, you know, I think there was a study that came out recently that found that, like, getting five or six hours of sleep every night is, like, the equivalent of trying to do something while you're buzzed. And this is dangerous. It's dangerous to our everyday lives. It's dangerous to our work. So self-care is getting enough sleep, eating right, making sure you're healthy, making sure your mental health is being maintained. And that's a really big part of it, because I think it's easy for women to kind of take on all these extra tasks without that, you know, aren't really acknowledged and do them and think that they're supposed to do them. And then self-care is usually the first thing that goes by the wayside. Like, I'll just not get an extra hour of sleep that night. I'll just sleep 5 hours instead of, you know, 6 or 7 hours. So that's a really important thing that you want to maintain. I think it also helps to seek validation. Like, I think that's why that Metafilter thread got so popular, because these women were getting validation from other women. And sometimes, again, it feels like it's just not something that you're supposed to think about or worry about or try to fix. It's just sort of a norm that's been an expectation that you are used to living with. But if you can talk to other women or just talk to your partner, your spouse, about how you're feeling and get that validation of, like, no, yeah, you're right. This is extremely stressful. And what you're feeling is not crazy. And we're going through it too. I think that really helps to have that kind of accountability.
We're talking to Kristen Wong. She recently wrote the New York Times piece, "There's a Stress Gap Between Men and Women. Here's Why It's Important. Women Reporting More Stress Than Men." She's with us to talk about the causes of that stress and what to do about it.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think about this stress gap between men and women? If you're a woman, have you noticed this in your life? What steps do you take to alleviate stress? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR.
We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time.
Right now, we continue our conversation about stress and how a number of factors can increase the stress levels of women compared to that of men. Our guest is Kristen Wong. She's a freelance journalist who recently wrote about the issue for the New York Times.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions for Kristen. And if you're a woman, do you see this in your own life? Do you feel this extra stress based on the expectations on you as a woman in a relationship, at work, you name it? You find you take on more of the domestic stuff, the emotional labor compared to your spouse or your male coworkers? What would you like to see change? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. To your calls now. Mary is with us in Wauwatosa. Mary, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Mary?
Well, my kids are grown, and I'm in my early 60s, and I think this emotional work situation is huge. And years ago, my friends and I realized that we, as women with kids, always had a tape in our head that was like a ticker tape moving constantly, and it was all things that had to be done, you know, make the doctor appointments for the kids, make the dental appointments, stop in and see the teacher, drop off this, drop off that, and just constant all the time. And we all kind of look at our husbands and realize they didn't have that. You know, they didn't have, I'm sorry, but they were really clueless about all of the things that had to be done in raising children. And I don't see that that's unfortunately changed at all with the generation of kids that I raised who are now having children. It still is the woman who's doing all of that stuff that I think is present, but not, you know, it doesn't scream, oh, I'm going to work and I've got to do this. It's just this constant activity that's got to be taken care of.
Mary, thanks for that call. That constant tape in their head. Kristen, this matches with a lot of the stories you heard.
Yeah, it really does. You know, and I talk about this personal experience in that article, but I kind of went on a strike with that stuff because I noticed that too with my husband. I was like, I have so much on my to-do list that's not work-related, and I have a full-time job just like he does. So why do I have this extra stuff? And so I remember I was like, I'm going on a strike. I'm not doing these extra things anymore. And he was like, oh, that's fine. I'll do them. And of course, you know, there was one instance where we were invited to a party and we were both on the email list. And I was like, typically I would be the one to put this on his calendar, put it on my calendar, remind him about it. But I was like, I'm going on a strike. I'm not doing that work. And so he's like, that's fine. I'll take care of it. Of course, we show up to the party 2 hours late and the host kind of made a comment that, like, just to let you know, we expected you much earlier, but she made the comment to me, you know, because I was the one expected to take care of all of this. And I can only imagine that's because I'm the wife and that's the role that's expected of me. I'm the one who's supposed to get us all together and make sure this happens. And it's very easy to become resentful of that, you know. I mean, I am perhaps lucky. I have a husband who is receptive to these things. And so having a conversation with him is good. It's productive and he understands this, but there are still some things that even I don't notice because, like Mary said, they've kind of been happening for years and you get used to them. And, you know, in some cases, I think it's very helpful to talk to a couples therapist, and it's helpful for any couple, but I think looking for a couples therapist who kind of specializes in maybe these gender expectations can kind of help, I guess, mediate that.
Mary, thanks a lot for calling in and sharing your story. We'll go next to Laura in New Berlin. Laura, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Laura?
I think this study is just fantastic that in this article that you've written, because it's something that I encounter in my daily life at my job as well as in my personal life. My husband and I have non-traditional gender roles because he is a stay-at-home parent and has been for almost 9 years, and I'm a full-time working parent, but yet I still feel like there are a lot of things that rest on my shoulders. And additionally, in my job, I work as a mental health therapist, and I work with a lot of women, and I preach self-care, but yet I still have a hard time finding the time for myself, too.
Mm-hmm. Laura, thanks for sharing your story. So, yeah, even with that non-traditional division of labor, Kristen, she's feeling that.
Yeah, and I also think it's again, because I think of those gender norms, you know, I've heard a lot of women say that when they do have those non-traditional roles, like men aren't really expected to be the caretakers. So when they do the work of a caretaker, they're praised for it more than a woman would be. It's just kind of expected. Whereas with men, it's like, it's noticed more. So then people acknowledge the work. It's interesting that, yeah, you still feel that way, even if, because I guess at the end of the day, you still have to, I don't know, you still have these norms imposed on you.
Thanks for that call, Laura. We're talking to Kristen Wong about her piece in the New York Times on a stress gap between men and women. Back to your calls. Jen is with us in Stoughton. Jen, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Jen?
Well, my husband wasn't raised to take care of appointments or anything like that, but he is trying. I'll give him that. Bless his heart. He tries. But I'm a working mom. I have a toddler. My son, my husband can't remember anything, so I'm making all the appointments, making sure we all get to the appointments, coordinating meals, making sure he doesn't lose his keys constantly. I mean, I'm just picked up my kid from daycare, and I'm standing in the Walmart parking lot talking to you guys because I got to go pick up dinner and snow pans and...
Jen, thanks a lot. Good luck getting that all together. I want to start with where she started, Kristen. Her husband wasn't raised to keep track of appointments. I mean, is this something that is going to take, I don't know, how many generations to fix, and maybe raising boys and girls with a different set of common expectations?
Gosh, I don't know. I would think that, yeah, it's something that... will change over time, I would hope. But then I go back to Mary's call, who says that, you know, this is something she's been dealing with and she sees her kids dealing with. So I think it's just, I think it's also, there's more attention on it, and that's great. I hope that women
keep thinking about it and keep taking it seriously. I think it's important to keep that in mind when you're searching for a partner, when you're working on your marriage, to find somebody who is receptive to this and who understands. Like, you could hear the exhaustion in Jen's voice just then, you know? To have somebody who understands where that's coming from and is open to listening to you about it. Because it's also, it's the ironic part is having to prove that emotional labor is a thing, or prove that, you know, whatever you want to call it, this extra labor that women have to do, this gender-based, I don't remember the amazing phrase that you used. But the
gender-based bonus stress, I think it was, yeah.
Gender-based bonus stress. Having to prove that that's a thing makes it self-fulfilling in a way, you know?
So in our last couple minutes, I mean, some of the solutions, the self-care kind of stuff sounds great, the validation you were talking about, in some ways those are symptom relief. Is there a way for workplaces, couples, to try to equalize that stuff in a non-angry sort of way between parties involved?
Yeah, you know, in the workplace, I think there's sort of a larger conversation here about what workplaces can do to kind of structure their environment in a way that acknowledges it a little bit more. But I think that some workplaces do a good job of this with something called affinity groups. So they will have, you know, for people who might feel marginalized in the workplace or just out of place, or like they're the minority in the workplace, often that is women, they have groups that you can kind of join and have that validation and feel like you're not, you know, the only one dealing with this. In a relationship, you know, that can be a lot trickier. I think finding a really good couples therapist, if your spouse, if your partner is not open to the conversation, having a third party to come kind of sit in on it and explain, look at things objectively and explain what's going on can be super helpful.
We'll leave it there for now. Kristen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Kristen Wong. She's a writer and journalist. She joined us to talk about a stress gap between men and women and why women, according to a lot of research, carry the most significant stress burdens and how they can push back on that and deal with it. She recently wrote a piece headlined, "There's a Stress Gap Between Men and Women. Here's Why It's Important." That appeared in the New York Times, and we have a link to the article. You can find it over at WPR.org.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, plans for a new electrical transmission line in southwestern Wisconsin are getting some pushback from conservation groups. We'll get two perspectives on the proposal.
On this week's edition of Food Friday, I'm looking forward to this. Vinegar can play a bigger role in cooking than just a tasty salad dressing. Learn more about the power of sour. I gotta say, I'll probably say it again tomorrow, 70% of the time when I'm cooking, when I think, this needs something, I don't know what, it needs something, it's vinegar. It's almost always vinegar. Yeah.
And when you were little, what did you want to be when you grew up? And did you try it out, or are you in that profession now? We want to hear from you about your childhood career dreams. Rob, what did you want to be?
I don't, you know, I'll have to think back about that. I don't remember. I do remember on a tape recorder trying to record a fake radio show.
I wanted to be a veterinarian.
All right. And
like,
here you are.
Like lots of kids.
That's all tomorrow on Central Time.